Hello?
Hi, Jonathan.
Hi, Megan. How are you?
I'm very well, thanks. Yourself?
I'm good.
Enjoying the pleasant Washington spring?
It's gorgeous here. Where are you? Where do you live?
I'm actually in D.C. I moved down here temporarily. I'm rotating through our D.C. office. So I just got back from New York, actually, where I was on a panel about risk. And
I love that game. I used to play that all the time in high school.
Actually, that might have been more interesting than the panel I was actually on, which was about whether we have nothing to fear but fear itself.
Right.
Should we be afraid these days? And
was Jacob Hacker on the panel?
What?
Was Jacob Hacker?
It was a New York Salon. It was basically, it was Frank Faridi, who does this culture of fear stuff, mm-hmm. and Chris Hayes from The Nation, and me. And I actually got booed for the first time. It was kind of exciting.
Huh. And no Jacob Hacker?
No Jacob Hacker.
It
was
like
much more, though, it was much less about economic risk than more broadly about the concept of fear and terrorism and global warming and some economic stuff as well. But it was a broader thing that I subbed in at the last moment for a senior economist journalist.
So. I see. Right. That used to happen to me all the time. I get C-SPAN invitations on, like, Thanksgiving weekend and,
yes.
Weekends of storms and times like that. Now, actually, they don't call me at all. Now, they never call me. I don't even know if they still have those shows. Do they still have those shows where journalists go on and get harangued by maniacs?
I don't know. For a while, I was doing a show for CNN-FN, like a morning show.
Yeah.
And it was, I always sort of felt guilty because I would be sitting there, because it's just such a short, weird format.
Right.
That I would be sitting there thinking, if anyone is actually listening to me and investing their money, like, the state should come in and take their money away, because they're clearly not competent to have charge of it. So,
which I always have the thought about Larry Kudlow. Does he give people advice about how to invest their money these days?
Yeah, all of those shows kind of. I mean, I got an MBA from the University of Chicago, where you mm-hmm. basically spend 2 years learning that you can't beat the market, so don't bother.
Right.
So I always kind of feel like it's vaguely criminal that that people are on television, sort of telling people, oh, you should put money in this stock or that stock. That's somewhat idiosyncratic, I think.
Right. Well, especially Kudlow, whose theory is that, like, everything depends on, like, the success of the Republican economic program. So, if the market's tanking, it must be because some Democrat introduced a bill to, repeal the Bush tax cuts that'll never pass. Nonetheless, that's got to be the reason the market's tanking or something.
He's a symptom of a broader phenomenon, which is that you read headlines in the Wall Street Journal, like, the market dropped on X. And sometimes it's pretty obvious why the market dropped.
Right.
But other times it's really not, and there's an explanation anyway. So they didn't go out and poll anyone. They have no idea why the market dropped. Sometimes more people wanted to sell than buy, and that's the only explanation. But everyone has to come up with a story. We're tremendous. This is what journalists do, right? We come up with a narrative for anything.
Right.
No one is ever able to say sometimes a stock market crash is just a stock market crash.
Fair enough. So what were we talking about? Should we talk about something
we were,
real?
We were going to talk about whether the Democrats need the Libertarians in 2008, whether they should bother or just let them fall by the wayside.
I say let them fall by the wayside. What's your response?
I'm pretty Libertarian, so that would make me sad. I think that no one wants us. And more realistically, I actually think that the Democrats got a big boost from the sort of moderate Libertarian voters in 2006, and I would hate to see them just sort of give up and go back. And in fact, like, as far as I'm concerned, they have given up, right? They've moved in an incredibly populist direction that I don't see carrying well into 2008 on the Libertarian side.
But, you mean like having the minimum wage, like, keep pace with inflation and other radical communist plans?
Well, the minimum wage is one area where, I, and also my publication, but I personally think that it's probably not going to do much damage, but it's also probably not going to do much good, and the good that it does do is extremely unlikely to do good for poor people. It's much more likely to redistribute money from poor people to middle-class teenagers, which seems sort of just lunatic to me. But in general, they've moved. Certainly the new crop of Democratic House of Representatives people are way to the left on trade of where the previous bunch were and where the Republican Party was. And I definitely wouldn't say that the Bush administration was perfect, but the rhetoric coming out of the House is kind of scary now.
Right.
For ardent pro-free traders like us.
Well, I think the thing we have to make clear is whether you're talking about substance or whether you're talking about politics. And you started off talking about politics, but then you kind of veered into substance. And you started off talking about how the Democrats were helped by getting this vote, but then you talked about how you don't think the minimum wage will help people. But that's, I mean, which do you want to talk about? You want to talk about politics at first.
There's two questions. Like, on a personal note,
right.
I would like to see the Democrats courting the Libertarians because I like the policies on which I would hope the Democrats would court the Libertarians.
Right. That's just a personal
desire, but I also want to be rich and have a Porsche.
Right.
On a political level, I think that the Libertarians, more than they have been in maybe ever, are up for grabs. The Iraq War and some of the other Bush administration policies has really put a huge number of Libertarians that I know in the category of being not just likely to abstain, but possibly to actually vote for Democrats, and a number of them I know did in both 2004 and 2006.
Right.
So it seems like it would be worth pursuing, but I don't think that you think that that's so.
Well, I don't think that's so. I mean, the problem is that Libertarians are basically a very tiny group of people with extremely unpopular views, and anything you do to, you know, court the Libertarians will lose you a far greater number of voters who believe basically the exact opposite of what the Libertarians believe. Minimum wage is a perfect example, you know, overwhelmingly popular issue, appeals to downscale, you know, we're talking about, you know, downscale voters with traditional views on social issues and more populist views on economics are a sizable and demonstrably swing voting group. They went for the Democrats also in 2006. Basically, everyone went for the Democrats in 2006. So
question for you, do you think that the Democratic Party should swing to the right on social issues in order to attract those voters?
Well, if you're talking about just political advice or, you know, what I believe, those are two different things. You know, political,
I think
political,
just
yeah.
I'm actually sort of cheered to hear you say that. Most people act as if their political advice, you know, the thing that they want to happen is also the same thing that should, that would be good political advice, and then they're shocked and horrified when no one takes their advice.
Right. Well, I mean, I'll give you a good example, you know, like religion and secular issues. I'm a very secular person. I think we should have, if anything, the stronger separation between church and state than we do now. And I find it very dismaying when political leaders cite religious inspiration for their public policies and religious rationales for the public policies. But, you know, politically, no, it's a great idea. I mean, if I was a Democratic consultant, I would be telling my candidates to talk about God all the time because it clearly works. I mean, that's one example. In general, I think, the elites in both parties tend to be more conservative on economic issues and liberal on social issues than the base in both the Democratic and the Republican parties. So to the extent that there's an underserved constituency out there, it's an anti-libertarian constituency. And both parties would probably do well to move in that direction.
Well, I guess part of the question, though, is you know, do you want to lead or do you want to follow? There has been an opening for the Democrats to come in and exploit fears about trade, and in fact, they've done it. And maybe there's no other way that politics can go. Maybe politicians always follow the electorate and sort of just blindly move where the electorate is. But I would like to feel like if the Democrats were more restrained in their rhetoric on trade, if they explained things clearly and said, you know, sort of the Clinton line, yes, some people will suffer and we should look for ways to help those people, but overall this is a good thing, that they might be able to move the electorate somewhat. I mean, this is really what, I listen to liberals talk and the Netroots sort of talk about 2008 and what's happening inside the Democratic Party where it's moving left and this is fantastic news and so forth. And their supposition, I mean, the way they see it, right, is that the Republicans, who are evil and wrong, managed to delude the American public into following them with this fantastic grassroots operation, and by going out and really selling their ideas hard. And they're asking for the Democrats to do that on the left, and I guess I'm kind of asking for the Democrats to do that on the right, pursue the Libertarian vote, and help me create a bigger Libertarian vote.
But the Libertarian vote is so tiny, I don't see the point of pursuing policies that it will simply alienate far more than the number of voters that you attract.
Well, Well, but in the long run, I at least could argue that some of these policies would create constituencies for themselves. I mean, if we had better trade policy, we might have more exports that would create a constituency for even freer trade, for example.
Well, maybe we should, before we continue on with this larger argument, unpack this thing about trade, because what do you see about, I don't see what the Democratic agenda is on trade at all. I mean, you mentioned rhetoric and rhetoric. I mean, are they planning to cancel any free trade agreements? What are their plans that are so horrifying?
They're not planning to cancel any, but they can certainly, as you undoubtedly know, the Doha round of World Trade Organization negotiations is currently happening now. It's basically been stalled for various reasons having to do with agricultural subsidies and blocks and blocks in the developing world that have become more militant, but also made it much harder to get a deal.
Right.
The Bush's fast-track trade negotiation authority expires this summer.
Yeah.
So one thing that the Democrats could do, undoubtedly will do, is deny him further trade promotion authority, which means basically that there will be no more trade deals, right. And that renegotiations of any aspects of current trade deals will be hamstrung.
Right. So that's fine. You obviously follow this more closely than me, but I just wanted to set the parameters of this discussion in a more accurate way, which is that the Democratic anti-trade protectionist agenda is just to, you know, expand for future free trade agreements at a much more slow pace than you would like. It's not Smoot-Hawley here. They're not.
I don't think that that's necessarily true, right? Lots of these things, you know, can come up for renegotiation. They'll have time periods on them. For example, right now there's the multi-fiber agreement, which had covered textile protections, expired in last year, and that caused, I'm sure you remember reading the headlines, the bra wars in Europe, where there was just all of a sudden everyone realized that there were all of these Chinese textiles flooding their market, undercutting competitors. Everyone freaked out.
I don't know why I wouldn't have read a headline that says bra wars, but somehow.
Well, both the U.S. and Europe put in these temporary measures that have somewhat dampened down the Chinese imports, but those have to expire in 2008 under the rules. So the question is, what happens next? Does a Democratic Congress say, oh, well, I guess everyone in South Carolina is going to go out of business, which is probably what will happen when these things expire, or do they start chafing at the bit about WTO negotiations? Do they start? There's all sorts of ways that a Democratic Congress can make things worse, not simply stop further expansion. On the other thing, but even more broadly than that, there's a huge amount to be done on trade. There are a lot of poor people out there who have a lot of stuff that they could sell us, making their lives a lot better and making our lives a lot better. And the Democrats can stop that process in its tracks. I'm not sanguine about that. That doesn't make me happy or just think, oh well, that's too bad. I mean, there's huge amounts of work to be done on trade.
Right. I mean, we should probably get back to our original question, but I guess my quick response to what you're saying is, you know, it's a response to economic insecurity, and what you have to do is try to do what Clinton attempted, but only very partially succeeded in doing, which is couple free trade expansion with measures to increase economic security. And the problem is, if you're in a context where, you know, you've got George W. Bush in the White House, and the agenda is cut marginal tax rates, you know, eliminate taxes on capital, et cetera, et cetera. In that context, you're never going to find a center-left constituency for free trade. It's got to be coupled with some ameliorative measures for the middle class, for workers who are hurt by it. My advice is to get someone like Bush out of the White House, and then I think you can try to rebuild that constituency. But
possibly. I'm not sure that I see a lot of the. I don't see any support. That's not what any of the Democrats are talking about. What they're talking about is not trade adjustment assistance. They're talking about putting massive labor standards on international contracts international trade agreements that will basically price all of the foreign labor out of the market. So it looks like we have a free trade agreement, but in fact we've said, well, you've got to pay your workers $8 an hour, at which point no one's going to build a factory in Malaysia.
It's so $8 an hour.
Maybe it would rebuild the constituency, but I think that as long as Democrats find it profitable and happy to bash foreign workers and say that they're somehow stealing our jobs, then I don't see the cause of trade advancing under a democratic agenda.
Right. I mean, I follow this obviously much less closely than you do.
Yes. So we should move back to the subject of libertarians and the Democratic Party.
Libertarians are never going to threaten.
I mean, the other question though is libertarians as a group, the sort of radical ideas that libertarians have.
Right.
Get rid of, privatize the roads, no drug laws whatsoever, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
And of course, not all libertarians, not even all libertarians have these ideas. I mean, that's
right.
Really sort of the very hardcore fringe. In
right.
the same way that most social democrats probably don't follow, quite the hardcore policies that conceivably could come out of, nationalize the coal industry and so forth. I have very few liberal friends who think that.
Right.
So the question is, are there more moderate libertarian policies, things like school vouchers, that capture a huge portion? I mean, those are not only widely supported by moderate voters, they've got huge support among African Americans, which is
right.
a key Democratic constituency. So
I don't see any evidence that's true. I mean, I remember, I haven't looked at the wider polling, but I remember in Michigan, there was a big voucher campaign in 2000.
I'm sorry, could you speak up just a little bit?
Sure. In Michigan, there was a big political fight over vouchers, and the conservatives went into it with the big assumption it's popular among black voters who are a big constituency in Michigan, and blah, blah, blah. It became, as soon as people learned about it, it became massively unpopular, and it was a huge drag on the Republican ticket. And the Republican candidates quickly stopped talking about it altogether because the association with vouchers was destroyed. Did you hear that?
Yes, I did.
Okay.
I mean, I think that depending, it's always situational. It's always, there's not going to be any one libertarian policy that's going to do well everywhere and so forth. But in general, those things do pull well. They pull well among, I think, voters that you could get, not just libertarians. I think that, in general, things like card check, is that going to pull well come 2008? When Republicans started running campaign commercials about, this guy voted against the secret election, his secret ballot, that's something that you could pander to libertarians on and probably pick up a lot more than just libertarian voters.
Yeah, that's a small kind of special interest. I mean, I'm for it, but it's a small special interest kind of legislation. But you were saying before that, libertarians may be a tiny group of people with massively unpopular views, but you can create a market for those views. But couldn't you basically say that about anything? I mean, couldn't you say that about socialism or almost any ideology? That it's massively unpopular, but if you push for it long enough, you can find the voters who will agree with it. I mean, that doesn't seem like a very sound political strategy to me.
That's an interesting question. I'll go back to vouchers as one area where, for example, this has been going back and forth on my blog and a number of liberal blogs and some libertarians. And there are areas for agreement between liberals and libertarians on this that aren't being exploited, possibly because the interest group politics of the Democratic Party make it impossible to exploit it. I mean, the fact is 25% of the what is it, 25% of the delegates to the Democratic National Convention are teachers.
Right. My wife's a teacher.
But the fact is that, libertarians don't just want to gut the schools. They genuinely want to educate children, and they think that vouchers will work. Democrats also genuinely
don't just want to gut the schools or don't want to gut the schools?
They don't want to gut the schools.
Okay.
No. But the allegation against me in particular was that
right.
I'm just interested in gutting the union. I don't really care about anything else. All I want to do is just make teachers unhappy. And this is not true. I, in fact, want to educate kids. Like most libertarians are in favor of vouchers. Like most conservatives are in favor of vouchers.
Okay.
There is some group of conservatives who basically, which is like the government to pay their bills at their parochial school they're already sending their kids to.
Right.
But most people are genuinely interested in improving the system, as are Democrats. And Democrats mm-hmm. think that you need to improve the system by spending more money on it. And libertarians think that you need to improve the system by making massive structural change. So why not combine those two policies and combine massive structural change with spending more money on the system and get sort of cross-party buy-in?
Yeah, no, I'm, I'm fine with that. But you know, in general, I think there are a couple. You're right. There are probably a couple issues like that that you can discover. You know, I'm not sure that how much of a political winner those are. You know, Brink Lindsey in his TNR essay talk about tax reform. You know, I think tax reform is great. Tax reform. You know,
right.
Tax reform. I think it's a great. You know, substantively, I think it's great. Politically, do I think it's going to help anybody? You know, no. I think it's something you do like when you're in office. You basically, you know, get everyone, all the, you know, leaders of both parties together and sort of just agree to a ceasefire and just try to write a good bill. But it's, you know, it's, I don't think that is, that's really something you can. It's just too hard to fight. It's too easy to demagogue politically. So.
Right. No, I agree with you that tax reform is very unlikely to happen in the current political environment. That's just, I mean, it's something that I think actually all of us policy wonk journalists, we can all agree, right?
Right.
We all know the tax code should be massively simplified, all the deductions should be done away with. Right. If you want progressive benefits, give people cash through the earned income tax credit. Everyone can agree on it, but
right. The
fact is it's just impossible.
Yeah, that, you know, getting rid of farm subsidies is another example, you know, right? You know, I would agree, libertarians would agree, we should eliminate all farm subsidies. But, you know, to say that the Democrats should do this politically, you know, of course they shouldn't do it politically. I mean, if I was running for office as a Democrat, I wouldn't be for that either, even though, you know, I think it's a great idea. I mean, I don't know if part of what you're referring to is the David Boaz paper on the libertarian vote, because that's like the basic text that everyone seems to refer to in explaining why Democrats should embrace the libertarian vote. And a shoddier piece of reasoning I have rarely seen in my life. I think
there's a question. So the paper, the way it defines who's a libertarian, is right. A very expansive definition.
Yes.
And that's a problem.
Yes.
On the other hand, there's an underlying reality to it, which is these are people who have, they're probably... I don't know what percentage of those people are actually what I would define as a libertarian. And I think of myself as being on sort of the far left wing of where you could be and still even vaguely define yourself as a libertarian. And there are a huge number of people who are agitating to kick me out of the movement, as it
right.
were. I think that in that sense, you're right.
I think there are many senses in which that paper is very bad. That's only one of them. I mean, to quickly, you know, David Boaz, for those who haven't seen it, wrote this paper about the libertarian vote and how this is an important swing constituency that Democrats should court. And as you say, his definition is extremely expansive, A. B, it relies entirely on vague and general statements about the role of government, And then it assumes that those will translate into specifics, which, of course, never works, as Newt Gingrich found out. You know, people wanted smaller government in general in 1995, but when you find out what you actually have to do to reduce the size of government, you know, all those specific programs are all popular. And C, it assumes that there's absolutely no trade-off between libertarians and anyone else. Would assume it just analyzes the libertarian bloc solely as a whole, so the Democrats could do everything to, you know, to court this tiny group, which is probably, you know, in my estimation, you know, 1 or 2%. Of the populace, and assumes like everything else will remain totally fixed, which is of course wrong. And so my example is, you know, Scientologists. If Scientologists were swing vote, you could say, well, sure, Democrats just go around and talk about L. Ron Hubbard and say insulting things about psychiatry, and that'll put you over the top. But of course, you know, lots of people will be repulsed by that, and I think the same basic dynamic is true with libertarians.
Two things about that. I mean, yeah. One thing is that, yes, they are broad statements, but I think that they do reflect a sort of political attitude about American society that could be exploited if Democrats and libertarians are willing to come together to manipulate the American public.
Right.
But the bigger point is that, you know, at some point you can say that's true, right? Like, some of these things are unpopular. But, you know, at what point do we just say, okay, well, then we should never have a policy about anything that doesn't poll perfectly. At which point, you know, I work for a classical liberal paper, you work for a neoliberal paper. Should we just go home and stop? And we shouldn't even have politicians. We should just run, you know, poll everything, see what the American public thinks, and then be done with it.
Well, no, we should just have another discussion about what we actually want to happen, which is what I, you know, do most of the time. I don't spend most of my time advising, you know, parties on how they should win. But, you know, if I do have the discussion, you just have to be, you know, realistic about it, I think.
No, I'm trying to be realistic here in the sense that, like, the easiest thing to do is just to, you know, I don't want to be contemptuous and say pander, but the easiest thing to do is just follow whatever is out there. That's right. The easiest thing for any politician. In fact, right. It's what a lot of them do. But at some point, you're running for office because you want to do something. And I actually think that there are areas in which the policymakers in the Democratic Party, or in the Democratic establishment, I should say more broadly, do agree with libertarians on a bunch of stuff.
Right.
And so it might be worth joining forces to try to push popular sentiment in those directions, and in doing so, get the libertarian and the libertarian-leaning Republican people, you know, to defect.
Right, I mean...
Maybe not.
You know, yeah, I mean, I think in general, the Democrats, what they certainly discovered, the main lesson of the last election is there's a big swing vote out there of downscale, traditional, you know, culturally traditional voters who are concerned about the economy. And, you know, if you can reassure them on values and biography and things like that, you can tap into that vote and get a real strong majority, and then you can have a lot to work with to change the country. And I think basically, you know, if I'm giving Democrats just pure political advice, that's what you do to build big majorities, and then you can have a little more flexibility with what you do, you know, in office. But that's the way to go, which is basically the opposite. I mean, not saying that there aren't some counterexamples here or there, but the broad thrust of what I advise them to do is to chase that big swing vote.
Demagogue trade, demagogue gay marriage, and then.
You don't have to demagogue gay marriage. You could just kind of pretend that you're not for it, which is sort of what they do. And I think it's
a demagogue trade.
Yeah, well, you know, like, that's part of it. You know, there are ways to do it. You know, you talk about, you know, I think what they try to do is, you know, is talk about it in a way that doesn't, you know, compel them to action very much. But on economics, I don't think, I mean, trade is obviously very important to you, but I don't think that's a major part of the Democratic agenda. And I don't think it's a big part of what they're talking about. I mean, it's something that you're keying into very closely, but, you know,
well,
they're,
I mean,
they're
also,
when they're attacking
it's certainly
George
not
Bush.
The only area in which right. I'm not, you know, I voted for the Democrats in 2006 and am now on the grounds that they couldn't possibly be worse than the Republicans, and the
right.
Democrats seem to be doing their best to convince me that I was wrong.
Right.
You know, the doing away with secret elections for unions. I mean, these are things that, like, libertarians care a lot about process. They care a lot about trade. They care a lot, but they also care a lot about process. And that kind of thing is exactly the stuff that turned them off the Republicans. The Republicans seem to have stopped caring about process. And that's why so many of them defected.
Right.
And maybe that's fine. Maybe we are just we're the redheaded stepchildren of politics, and no one cares about us.
The sooner you come to that realization, the happier you'll be.
Well, I've already long adjusted to the fact that I disagree with the American public on just about everything.
Right.
I
disagree with the public on a whole lot. So, I guess I can comfort myself in a few areas, though. Why don't we go on to topic number, depending on how you keep count, 2 or 7, which was Tyler Cowen's column in the New York Times today.
Yes.
About healthcare.
Yes, it's one of the, because I expect that is something that is definitely going to hit the aisle again in 2008.
Yeah.
And I know, I believe at least that that's something I've read you write about before.
A little bit, you know. Jonathan Cohn is our major healthcare guy here.
Right. No, I just read his book actually.
I've only read a little bit of it, but it's really, really good. The part I read.
it's a little light on data and heavy on anecdote for me. I'm afraid, like, this is actually the bane of my existence about healthcare policy in general, is that the entire thing seems to be conducted with heart-stirring debates where you know, one side pulls out the woman whose diabetes went untreated because she couldn't afford to go to the hospital, and the other side pulls out the guy in Canada who died of brain cancer because he was put on a waiting list that wouldn't have happened in the United States. And the fact is, no system is going to serve every single person as well as they could conceivably be served in the universe of possible things. It will, you know, what you're looking for is the average and the median, not
That's
to
right.
see if you can make every, nothing is pretty awful.
I know John's book is packed with data, and John is incredibly rigorous and fair, incredibly thorough about backing up his arguments with data. But I can't say I've read the entire thing. But
well, the entire thing, you know, each chapter is basically, it's the narrative of one person in the system, and then the, you know, the data is sort of tacked onto that narrative, which is I'm sure makes it more engaging for the average audience, but it sort of just sets me the wrong way,
right?
Because it starts off in a place that I think is way too prevalent already in the healthcare debate, which is, you know, sort of my grandmother died, therefore this is how we should make policy happen,
right?
Which is, I think, one of the many reasons our healthcare policy is such a mess now. But yeah, the column is actually about administrative costs, and this is really interesting because it's one of the sort of two or three big selling points that single payer advocates have, and I assume we're gonna see some version of either a stripped down almost single payer or an actual single payer on display in the 2008 election.
Right. Yeah, go on. Why do you want to summarize the argument?
The basic argument is this: is that in fact, like, there's maybe you should summarize the argument because you're going to have a less kind reading of it than I do.
Okay, I think basically Tyler Cowen said, "Well, there are a lot of facts out there that don't fit my theory, so the facts must be wrong." And, you know, the facts are that all these European countries have vastly lower overhead and administrative costs for their healthcare system. And yet their outcomes are, by almost any measure, at least as good or superior to the United States. So something must be wrong, because this doesn't fit my libertarian model. So in what he seized on, he said, well, there must be things that we're losing or things that we're getting in response for these massive administration and overhead costs in the United States. By paying doctors far more, we must be getting something better. Or people must be waiting much longer for their health care in Europe. He presented no evidence that this is true.
Well, they are observably waiting longer. I mean, the waiting lines for procedures are longer in Europe and Canada.
What's your source of data for that?
I mean, there's multiple sources on it. I mean, waiting 11 months to have a bypass operation is not a common thing.
Right. Well, first of all, I mean, I was talking about Europe, and all these countries are bad comparisons because they spend so much less on healthcare than we do. But Canada, especially. But, you know, let's talk about, like, you know, France and Germany, which I think are, like, you know, especially France.
Well, but that's always the thing, right? So I'm not going to have that healthcare system. I'm not going to have the bad one. It's not going to have any of the bad features. It's only going to have the good features of the countries that I like. And then if I talk about the bad features of Germany, I say, well, we're not going to have that either. You know.
Well, whatever. I'm not a healthcare journalist, and obviously you are, but I'm willing to confine myself to one country. But I think it's fine to say, yeah, let's take the best system or the best systems we can find across the country, across the world, and not do the bad ones. I mean, that seems like a totally fair thing to say.
Well, but France doesn't spend that much less on. I mean, they spend less, but, you know, right. Like the systems that spend a lot, that spend dramatically, hugely less than we do, like half of what we do.
France does what, like 70% of what we do, something like that?
I believe last year they were at 11%. I could be wrong about that, though. 11 or 12, and we're at 15.
Right.
Their rate of healthcare growth is fairly similar to ours.
Right.
Everyone's rate of healthcare growth. You know, they're starting from a lower base, but it grows just as fast.
Right. So they spend about 70%. You know, that's, I mean, if I'm doing my math right, that's in the ballpark of 70% or slightly less of what we do in healthcare, right?
Right. But part of the problem, right, is that everyone talks as if we can get to that. It's a lot easier not to give someone a new procedure than it is to take it away once they have it.
Right.
You know, it's a lot easier to say, well, Canada doesn't have a lot of MRI machines. It's a lot easier to not have them than to decommission ones you have.
Right.
So, first of all, we're not going to get there because no one is going to say, oh, well, you had this medicine last year, but this year you don't get it. And so, and this is the where it comes down to is everyone talks about administrative costs. We're going to cut administrative costs. The other big area open for savings is we're going to cut doctor and nurse's salaries, but I don't see that politically happening. You know, they both have pretty powerful lobbies, particularly the healthcare unions are extremely strong and only get stronger when the government gets into healthcare management. You know, there's already a shortage of nurses, so it's hard to batten down their salaries too far.
Right.
But then when the government gets involved, as you see in, like, New York State, where the government is heavily involved in the provision of hospital care, the union gets just these incredible deals because they lobby the government, and the government, you know, Pataki cut a deal with $11.99 that gave them these gigantic wage increases. But you know, so it's the magic of administrative costs, and you know what I took out of Tyler's article is look, you can't really, they're not really commensurate, and that's something. You know, part of the problem is that a lot of the things in administrative costs that get written off to the government are actually get charged off to administrative costs in a private company. They're done by the government, but they're done by another arm of the government. So if you have fraud checks, that's done by the Auditor General. You know, the Auditor General is the one who makes sure that the people in Medicare administration aren't running off with the cash.
Mm-hmm.
So that gets charged to that part of the government. It doesn't get charged to, if the government has said you can't sue me to recover, for example, pain and suffering. So it's a lot less profitable to sue Medicare. So you have fewer lawsuits, whereas an insurance company has to have that overhead. There are undoubtedly some areas in which, I mean, having one billing procedure is probably simpler than having three, but or eight or whatever we have. But these are actually, they're pretty trivial. I mean, it's not like the retail sector just doesn't function because Walmart has 100 suppliers.
Right.
And Walmart would, and we'd all suddenly be better off if Walmart only had one supplier to deal with. And then, you know, the other areas are areas often where you're just shifting something out. For example, the revenue collection and is done by the IRS. So the billing there's no billing procedure. That doesn't mean that, you know, people don't get billed. And in fact, there's a huge cost to taxation, which you don't have in the private sector, which is the deadweight loss of taxes. And that is a cost that you should be imputing if you were going to do a real calculation of the economic cost of these programs. You would add that to the bill. You would say, well, people who were taxed have now done less productive work because their tax rates go up, and that's something you see, at least, you know, economists now think that we have explanations for things like why do people in Europe have more leisure? It's because their work is less profitable. So all of those deadweight losses should be added in and aren't. And so, of course, the explicit cost looks lower, but the actual cost is higher.
The actual cost of the European system.
Right. There's also things like formal innovation. You know,
doesn't mention anywhere in his column is by far the biggest administrative overhead cost, which is the money that insurance companies spend chasing away sick people and reeling in healthy people. That's the big one. That's the cost you get rid of.
Do you have any evidence that they spend a lot of money on that? That's not actually something that's very hard. I mean, it's not something I would spend a lot of money on. Someone has a pre-existing condition, I send them a letter saying I'm not covering it. That's not...
Right. There's all kinds of things you do in terms of marketing and positioning yourself to not get those customers, to drop them, to find out who they are, how you can identify them, how you can keep them away, and how you can find the people who are healthy. I mean, that's my understanding of the data. I mean, I actually just like called John Cohn and asked him about that data question. He didn't give me a number, but he said that's by far the biggest expense right there, and that's not mentioned anywhere in Tyler Cowen's article.
Well, right, but I mean, Medicare doesn't. You know, Medicare's sort of similar thing is it's easy. We just say you're over 65 or you're a U.S. citizen. It's really easy, but you know what other costs is that masking? I guess is the question.
Well, it's not. You're just getting
Medicare,
rid of the cost.
You have no right of appeal. If I'm
right,
so the cost to those people, does that go into the system? Does it come out of it? You know, like Medicare handles its issues of I won't pay for that in a different way. One could argue both ways that it's a more or less efficient way. Medicare gets to issue blanket no. We just don't do that, which is very efficient.
Right, but what does that have to do with?
In some sense,
I'm not sure what that has to do with discriminating amongst your customers and finding the right customers and getting rid of the ones you don't want. That's just a cost, a huge cost of the American healthcare system that you would get rid of if you had single payer. And it wouldn't reappear in any other form. It's just something you don't have to do. It's fundamentally something that has no social value at all. In fact, it has enormous negative social value.
Right,
it's just a cost.
Part of it, right, is that the reason that insurers, my impression is the reason insurers spend so much time doing that is that in so many markets they are forbidden from pricing to people by risk. And so you have to spend a huge amount of time identifying people that you don't want to insure.
Right.
Because you aren't allowed to spend any time saying, okay, I will insure you, but I will insure you at a higher price.
Right.
So,
because,
you know, is
because
that
a
market
that's
issue
a function
or
of a market.
Is that a regulatory issue?
That's a function of having a market. That's just a... I mean, it's always going to be profitable in a market system to the, by far the most important factor in whether you're profitable is the health composition of your clients, by far. So it's always, in a market system, it's always going to make sense to devote enormous amount of resources to chasing away as many sick people as you can get and reeling in as many healthy people.
I guess it's, you know, in a, for example, in a national system, you do it in a much less granular way, right? You say, people with this don't get treated like this. So you don't chase them away. You just take them in and don't give them treatment.
But that's not happening in Europe. I mean, help by every
outcomes between Europe and the United States, because for reasons that we don't fully understand, African Americans, even when you can control for income and education, et cetera, they live less long than Americans do. So, and like, it complicates infant mortality. There's just a lot of, it's just like the Japanese are the longest lived people in the world. No one thinks that this is because the Japanese have the best healthcare system.
Right.
So that's just one. You have ethnic issues and practice issues and data collection issues that make the data sort of confusing on a lot of these statistics.
I agree.
Used to prove that the American healthcare system actually sucks in comparison to France.
I agree. Every single statistic you look at, taken individually to try to measure the difference in the quality of healthcare systems, is problematic because you're looking, like you say, at different populations with all kinds of differences. But the problem is, there are all kinds of statistics, and as a whole, they paint the same picture, and that picture becomes quite compelling.
I'm only aware of two. I'm aware of this. I mean, because then when you get to like the WHO level, it's so weird with what they consider to be sort of a health measure.
Right.
I mean, they say that we're better, that Morocco is better than the United States because there's less disparity in how much is spent on people, which is just lunatic. So the only two measures that I'm aware of where the United States is consistently low that I would consider to be sort of serious measures are lifespan and infant mortality. Those are the two that are almost always cited.
There are other ones. I mean, there's, first of all, just like satisfaction, you know, surveys of how satisfied are you with your health care. That's an important measure. I mean, it doesn't tell you everything, but it's a measure. It tells you something.
I caveating that survey data cross-culturally really, really complicated to calibrate.
Sure. I mean, there are other ones, you know, like how long do, you know, how do people treat it fair when given, you know, the same disease, you know, people with cancer, people whatever. And, you know, the defenders of the American system always will, you know, point out to say, well, look at all the following technological gizmos that are available in the United States and aren't being applied in Europe. But people aren't actually, you know, when getting the same diseases, they aren't actually getting healthier any faster.
I'm actually not sure that that's true. For example, I'm aware of, for example, some of the lifespans on cancer seem to be a lot shorter. If you sort of match diagnoses and stages, your lifespan when you get cancer seems to be shorter in some European countries, for example, Britain.
Right.
The problem is that when you get cancer, you die pretty quick. And that's, you know, maybe that's a question. Should America be spending huge amounts of money to give someone who has cancer an extra year? My personal opinion is, you know what, when you've got to the point where you have an entire row full of, like, paper products for blowing your nose into in the grocery store, yeah, why not? What else are we going to spend the money on? But, you know, for example, the only study that I'm aware of that has really sort of compared major disease outcomes in countries seems to indicate, it was the McKinsey study that came out recently, seems to indicate that in fact, for most diseases, treatment is better and produces better outcomes in the United States if you sort of control for various factors.
Well, like I said, I haven't looked at this in a really long time,
right.
So I can't cite a specific study, but all I can say is my recollection of the data is just the opposite.
Well, I think that the broader question is, and this is the promise of single payer, and this is what I really sort of take issue with, is the promise that we're going to spend less on this, that once we get single payer, we're both going to cover more people, and it's also going to cost us a whole lot less. And I just find that wildly implausible. That's sort of what Tyler is getting at, is like, you know, it can cost less if we do less. It's not going to cost less and us have the same level of quality that we enjoy now.
Right, but no, I,
And that's,
I agree with you. I agree with it that you can't, we couldn't immediately, by putting in the French system, we couldn't immediately get the same results in terms of cost and consumer satisfaction and outcomes that they get right away. I agree. There's too many, you know, problems built into the system. There's too many things you can't change overnight. That's right. I mean, we'd be lucky if we just got a system that was just slightly more expensive and covered basically everybody and had, you know, roughly the same outcomes. I mean, I think that would be great. You know, if basically you could just, like, because of, use the efficiencies to cover everybody, and then, you know, the cost issue was just a wash instead of a big savings. I'd be satisfied with that.
But the efficiencies are small. Like, if you look at administrative costs as the overall percentage of the overall cost of healthcare, you know, people act as if they're huge. In fact, it's something like, you know, when you go all in, administrative costs on private healthcare in the United States, if we slash them in half, which I find pretty implausible. Mm-hmm. But say we slash it to Medicare-like levels. We take them from 7% to 3.5%. So now you've taken the cost of healthcare. You will have shaved a percentage point off of what we spend on healthcare in the United States.
As a percentage of GDP?
You'll have gotten us down to spending 14.6% of GDP or whatever we spend on it.
Right.
That's it. That's where the savings are. They're not that big. People forget how much money Medicare already spends in the American healthcare system.
Right.
The government is already 40% of our spending. So we're actually, yeah, like, we're not going to get to France levels. We could cut our administrative costs by 2/3 and not get anywhere near France. So that can't be the problem. Administrative costs cannot be what's driving American healthcare so high.
Right. I mean, there are a lot of issues that are made. I mean, I agree, but.
So the notion that you're going to cover another 45 million people who are allegedly not getting health care with that 1% of GDP just strikes me as bizarre. I don't understand.
The ultimate point of his column was that he said there's no free lunch and there's all the money that we're spending, we're getting something for, and I just don't think that's correct at all.
So aside from bouncing people out, so say that bouncing people out, I mean, it's actually not. It couldn't possibly be 50%. But say that bouncing people out of the system is a third of everything that insurance companies, all of their overhead, a third of that is just dedicated to locating sick people and making sure that they never get any health care. So now you've saved, 0.7% of GDP? Where's the other extra money coming from? Besides that, I mean, I assume I concede everything to you and we've gotten rid of all of it, we do none of it anymore. Where are the other savings coming from?
I can't argue on this basis at all because I almost never write about healthcare issues. I only read about healthcare issues, but I don't, you know, research it. So the problem is you want to have the discussion at a level that I'm just incapable of having with you. You know, you probably should be having this debate with Jonathan Cohn.
Probably, but he writes about it more than me, so we'd be having it. I want to know if people have answers to this. I want to know what do they see? You know, the inequity issue is a separate issue, but it becomes conflated. You know, people start making sort of deep claims about the healthcare system in order to get the equity issue resolved. And I guess what I'm wondering is, like, what level of spending would you cap it at? What level, how much of GDP would you be willing to spend to insure everyone?
Oh, that's a good question.
Were actually the first single-payer advocate I've ever heard who just said, yeah, we'll be lucky if... I mean, that was great. They said, yeah, we'll be lucky if this doesn't cost a huge amount more than we're already spending.
Well, you know, that's not too much different from, you know, when I've talked to Jonathan Cohn. You know, that's not too different from what he says. He says, look, you know, it's not a panacea. You know, there are trade-offs involved. You're probably not going to save very much money. You're probably, you know, the savings are probably going to get eaten up in insuring new people. You know, so if you can just, like, be spending about the same or maybe slightly a bit more and then covering everybody else, that's probably where you might end up. I mean, I think I'm paraphrasing pretty well what his view is. So again, this is another reason why you need to be debating healthcare with him, someone who dives into the data all the time. I mean, I do look at the data from time to time, but then I sort of extrapolate broad, you know, principles from it and then forget the data points that led me to adopt those principles in the first place.
So back to the question, how much do you think is a reasonable amount for us to spend? I mean, let's say I'm right and it's going to cost a lot more. Like, where would you cap it? At what point would you say, you know, that's just too much for society to be spending on healthcare.
Right. So if you're saying, so if I, if we're, I'm accepting your premise that basically, like, we're not going to save any money at all, and it's just a matter of how much more are we spending to achieve.
Right. I was just sort of curious.
A premise I reject, but working
right,
on.
Right. No, completely, not conceding anything. Just curious.
Right. Operating on your contested premise, I don't know, another 3, maybe 4% of GDP.
So if it was more than that, would you be against a national healthcare program?
Well. You know what? So if it's like, I'm not going to have some line where it's like, if it hits 4.1, I'm bailing out.
No. I mean, if it were like double that. So.
Yeah. I think so. I mean, whatever. I would have to look at the total plan and what it did to everything. But so it's really hard to answer a question like that without any context. But
well, maybe a secular question to wrap this up for our readers. Since you're I'm the policy wonk. You're the experienced political guy. What do you see the Democrats doing in 2008 on healthcare and school vouchers and the major? I mean, what do you see as the major economic issues going into 2008? What do you think the Democrats and the Republicans, respectively, are going to do?
Well, usually what parties do is they focus on whatever bad aspects there are to the economy and emphasize those and often tailor their plans to address those flaws, or at least pretend to tailor their plans for those flaws, whatever those flaws may be. So, you know, in 1996, Bob Dole was running against what he called the Clinton crunch. I don't know if you remember that phrase.
Yes.
And the solution happened to be a huge cut in marginal tax rates, which, you know, that's the Republican solution to everything. How the Democrats are going to run and what their economic program will be will depend on how the economy is doing. And if the economy is doing great, you know, what sort of dark clouds they can find in the economy and say, well, we'll solve this or that. You know, one might be, they could talk about rising inequality, or if that's sort of too scary to middle-class voters, they can frame it in terms of economic insecurity and fluctuations like Jacob Hacker. And that seems to be, and of course, if the economy has tanked by then, they could run on just about anything because they're just going to win. So they could just basically run. They could just run on whatever they want to do when they're in office, because it won't matter.
Do you think it's likely? I mean, do you think there's a possibility the Republicans are going to win in 2008?
Sure. I mean, yeah. I mean, I'd probably say Democrats are, I don't know, 55, 45, 60, 40 favorites. I don't know. What do you think?
I don't know. On the one hand, it's, you know, you've got three candidates who can at least plausibly distance themselves from George Bush.
Yeah.
On the other hand, I just think that, you know, the American public still got a lot of mad left to work out.
Yeah.
And anyone standing around with a Republican label. Actually, my mother is the swing voter. Every year, every election, my mother, who my mother votes for, turns out to be who the American public voted for as well.
Who does she like?
So she's so far cloudy. She's not committing yet, but I suspect she'll vote for a Democrat in 2008.
Right.
And if the logic holds. The interesting question I have is what, I blogged about this a little while back, is what happens, is HDTV going to shift this election the way that television did in the 1960 election? I have a theory now, because I was watching the political shows on my dad's brand new HDTV on Sunday morning. And some of the politicians look really bad. I would never, in ways that, you know, it's not like I ever thought that Arlen Specter was gorgeous.
Right.
But he looks hideous on HDTV. I'm kind of wondering if Barack Obama isn't going to win just because he's the youngest and has the best skin.
That's a good theory. You know, like, I think I'm in the same boat as you. I don't have HDTV. My parents do. But the only thing I've ever watched there is sports. So
I highly recommend go home one weekend and turn on the McLaughlin group, or turn on Meet the Press, actually, which is what we're watching. And it was just sort of flabbergasting. I'd never realized. And I'm actually sort of most interested in McCain, because apparently I'm told he's quite frail when you see him in person.
Right.
And looks quite unhealthy. And I wonder if that comes over on HDTV.
Do you know what percentage of households have HDTV?
I actually don't, but I also know that by 2000, so this is a year and a half out, right?
Right.
And actually, I know that they've just recently in the market, there's been this new development with these like these really bargain basement. There's this company that's come in, the name of which temporarily escapes me, but they're marketing, they're below cost. They sold LCDs this Christmas. So I suspect that another 18 months, with all of these firms flooding into the market trying to get share, that what we may see is a lot more Americans than we think having HGTV and turning on the debates to think, oh my God, who is that? Who's that wrinkly old orange?
Right.
John Kerry's tan, John Kerry's fake tan, which looks totally fine on CBS, is just appalling on HGTV. He actually looks like an orange that you've left in the sink for like, you know, 6 weeks too long.
Well, if I get nothing else out of this, I guess I know that I can, maybe I can actually buy an HGTV. I thought of it as something that would be financially out of reach. But
I'm afraid for this journalist, still financially out of reach.
Yeah, but maybe you know, in a year and a half, if cheap, below-cost products are out there.
Yeah, they'll be selling them for, like, the price of a pack of Oscar Mayer bologna, in which case I think they might fall into my price range. I'm not
sure. It's always that point in the technology cycle that I tend to jump in, that it's just, like, marketed, you know, on a mass basis to morons, basically.
Oh, see, I tend to jump into the technology cycle right before whatever I buy goes obsolete.
Oh,
it's
yeah.
It's sort of a special gift of mine.
Right, that's the next step.
Anyway, I'd better let you go because I see we've been on for almost an hour.
All right.
If I'm reading this right.
Okay, well, yeah, we should definitely go.
Thanks for the interesting conversation. And
you too. I'm sorry I'm not up to your wonky standards. I really rarely have discussions with people who are so much more wonky than me. And,
No, I feel bad actually because I should tell the readers I basically just sort of copped out of any political discussion because on the grounds that I have no knowledge in that area.
Right. And then we force the discussion
to go
terms that you have expertise in and I don't. So next time we'll talk only about topics that I know, that I follow and you don't know.
Yes, next time we'll talk about the White House prosecutors, which unfortunately I was only prepared to say, you know, seems bad. Haven't followed it.
Okay.
But take care.
All right, you too.
Bye-bye.